hell.
Where, what is it? Where is it? How to Get There, by Robert C. Newman. This was a talk that's been given only about twice by me, one of them quite recently, but the other one way back in the Halloween season of 1982. I was asked to give a talk on hell at Temple University, and gave the original version of this talk while they had the Christian group had somebody dressed in a devil suit running around outside trying to attract people into the session. Basically, we're going to discuss those three areas. What is hell? Where is hell? How do you get there? Well, let's go. Why am I giving a talk like this when I don't like in-your-face confrontation? Well, it's because of an incident that I witnessed in the summer of 1966 at the Madison, Wisconsin Zoo. I was out to Madison, University of Wisconsin at Madison, for about a month, 3 weeks maybe, at a conference on cosmic gas dynamics the summer before I finished my doctorate. And one afternoon, we were free, and so I went by myself to the Madison Zoo. While I was there, I saw a walk by the elephant cage, and there were some children playing very near the elephant cage inside the outer barrier. The elephant cage had a outer barrier that was probably waist high or a little lower. And then about 10 or 15 feet in from that, maybe even 20 feet in from that, it actually had the cage. And the bars on the cage were designed to keep the elephant in, not to keep other people out. Well, as I saw this, I thought that was very foolish for children to be playing in that area. But there were two women there who I believe were their mothers, so I thought I'd better not interfere. So I went on, and a few minutes later, I heard a scream from down there. And it turned out the youngest child had either been crawled or been pulled through the bars and was being trampled to death by the elephant. Here's the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal for the next day with the big headline, Zoo Elephant Winky Grabs Kills Girl 3. The child went under the fence to feed animal popcorn was the story that was being told. some of the features of the story I think were not accurate, but that one I think perhaps may have been. Anyway, that certainly had a big impact on me, and may have been partly influential in my going to a seminary directly after finishing my doctoral program. Some months after this event, I decided to take this incident as a sort of a parable. I thought I could have said something to the kids or to the mothers, and maybe they would listen to me, and if so, that would have saved this child's life, but I didn't. So I thought of the spiritual significance, something like that, and it suggested that I ought to use my life helping people to avoid hell, even if some of them might not appreciate being warned. I thought it would be better to do that than to let them go there without a warning. So that's part of the reason I constructed this talk, which then it was turned into a PowerPoint talk. Well, we look at our first topic then. What is hell? Well, there are many misconceptions about hell due to various traditional ideas. Some of the misconceptions involve what you have to do to get there. Some of them picture Satan as a jailer rather than as a prisoner, or the demons as the tormentors, etc. And those are the sort of features, I suppose, that have caused many to dismiss the whole idea as merely ancient superstition. Of course, others have done so because of wishful thinking, perhaps. What does the Bible have to tell us about this subject? Well, let's look at the biblical descriptions of hell, or more accurately, what happens to people who are unsaved when they die. I'm going to look first of all at Isaiah 66, the last few verses of the prophet Isaiah. It says this, NIV text, "As the new heavens and new earth that I make will endure before me, declares the Lord, so will your name and descendants endure. From one new moon to another, from one Sabbath to another, all mankind will come and bow down before me, says the Lord. And they will go out and look on the dead bodies of those who rebelled against me. The worms that eat them will not die. The fire that burns them will not be quenched. And they will be loathsome to all mankind. So if we try to put together a list of things that characterize hell, we'll do kind of a bullet point for each of the passages we look at. The one for this first passage is corpses, worms, fire, loathsomeness. Okay? We can't tell for sure how much of this is literal, how much is figurative. We'll come back and say a word about that further on, but that's our first passage. Second passage is found in the Daniel 12, verses 1 through 3. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There'll be a time of distress, such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So this speaks both about, well, I'd say believers and unbelievers, if you like, and hell is characterized in the second bullet as shame and everlasting contempt. Third passage comes from Jesus, Matthew 10:28. He says, "Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell." So, destruction of both body and soul, another characterization. Over in Matthew 13, verses 40 through 42, and then verses 49 through 50, are the concluding verses of two of Jesus' parables and his parables, the kingdom. Verses 40 through 42 are the concluding lessons, if you like, from the parable of the wheat and weeds, or the wheat and the tares, his traditional name. And Jesus says, "As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The other parable, ending in 49 and 50, is the parable of the dragnet. A dragnet, or a seine, is a type of a net that's got floats along one long side and sinkers on the other long side, and you throw it out in such a way that the sinkers sink to the bottom of the lake or the edge of the seashore or something where it's not real deep, and the floats float up on the top, and so then you close this long thing around, and the fish that are inside can't get out, and then you pull the whole thing on shore, and then the fishermen sort out the good saleable fish from the bad worthless fish, if you like. And so Jesus ends this by saying, this is how it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into the blazing furnace, where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So you see, both of them have this blazing furnace and weeping and gnashing of teeth. So that's our fourth characteristic, fiery furnace, weeping, gnashing, that is grinding of teeth. Mark 9, verses 42 through 48. Jesus says, "If anyone causes one of these little ones," perhaps it's a child, "those who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for them if a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell, where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. Better for you to enter the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God, with one eye than to have 2 eyes and be thrown into hell, where the worms that eat them do not die, and the fire is not quenched." You may recognize that last verse is a quotation from the Isaiah 66 passage we just looked at. So hell is characterized, fifthly, if you like, that it's better to lose one's life, one's hand, one foot, one eye, than not doing so to go to hell. Luke 16, we'll look at two panels here. This is the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, or traditionally the parable of Dives and Lazarus, where, however, Dives is basically just Latin for rich man. Jesus says, there was a rich man who dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores, longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he's comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been set in place, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. He answered, Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham replied, They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. He said, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. So, hell is characterized here as torment, agony of fire, no relief. Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians 1:9, they will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. So we might characterize that then as everlasting destruction, shut out from God's presence. In the book of Revelation, we'll look at two passages, Revelation 14, 9 through 11. A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, If anyone worships the beast and its image, receives its mark on their forehead or on their hand, they too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured out full strength into the cup of his wrath. They'll be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. The smoke of their torment will rise forever and ever. There'll be no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and its image, or for anyone who receives the mark of its name. So, hell characterized as wrath of God, tormented with fire and sulfur. Smoke rises forever, no rest. A last passage, Revelation 20, the last judgment, if you like. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, the death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. The last characterization, lake of fire, second death. So if we read through all these bullets again, then hell is characterized as corpses, worms, fire, loathsomeness, shame, everlasting contempt, destruction of both soul and body, fiery furnace, weeping, gnashing of teeth. Better to lose one's life or hand or foot or eye and be saved than go to hell with all of those. Torment, agony of fire, no relief, everlasting destruction, shut out from God's presence, wrath of God, tormented with fire and sulfur, smoke rises forever, no rest, lake of fire, second death. Well, that's the picture. How much of that is figurative and how much of that is literal? I guess we'll find out someday. But at this point, we can certainly say that figures mean something. They stand for something. And all of the stuff here is certainly enormously unpleasant. And so it's nothing that you want to experience yourself, particularly as it's pictured here as everlasting. Well, this is not a complete listing of the passages about hell, but it does include most of the major passages and pictures, except for the concept of outer darkness, given in Matthew 22 and 25. You might wonder how you can give outer darkness and fire, but I think the simple answer to that is the Bible gives a number of different figures for hell, and one of them is being shut out, tossed outside, if you like, from all the joy and festivity going on inside. You're out in the dark. And another one is this burning torment, if you like. We look at other biblical figures, for instance, about the relationship of God and humans. There are a whole series of pictures there, and they're not all consistent with one another because they're intended each to picture certain features of the relationship of God and man. So we have God as the potter, and where's the clay? God as the farmer, and we're the plant. God as the shepherd, and we're the sheep. God as the king, and we're his subjects. God as the master, and we're his slaves. God as the parent, father primarily, and we're his children. God as the husband, and we're the wife, etc. So we get that kind of picture here, I think, and we will one day find out what that's all about. So not a place you want to go. Well, that's what is hell. Where is hell? There are also some misconceptions here, some of them based on the literal idea that the Bible teaches a three-story universe with heaven as the attic and hell as the basement. I think there's some sense in which that's true, but not in the sense that if you dig a hole in the ground, you can get down to hell, or that if you climb high enough in the sky, you'll get up to heaven, but rather that we live in some kind of a universe in which there are different dimensions, and you can go up into the heaven dimension or down into the hell dimension, etc. And just how that's to be visualized is hard to say. I have a separate PowerPoint talk called Where is Heaven that you might find helpful in this particular regard. The view of Dante in his Divine Comedy is only slightly more sophisticated. He does, at least in his treatment of hell, have Satan as the chief prisoner and not as the warden, if you like. But he does really have a picture, at least in the story, of going down into the earth into through a cave to get into these lower levels, and then coming up the other side and coming out onto the surface of the opposite side of the earth, and then going up to purgatory and to heaven, etc. But I think at his time it was not known for sure whether there was anybody on the other side of the earth. Nobody had been around as far as they knew. Well, others have claimed that the biblical view of hell is a physical cavern in the earth to which bodies roll after burial. I actually saw that in a, don't remember whether it was a commentary or a discussion of the biblical pictures of various things, biblical cosmology. A foolish idea, basically, even though it was pictured by a scholar of some note. The problem is it doesn't fit some of the phenomena observed by the ancients themselves. Certainly the Egyptians, with their pyramids and royal tombs and things of that sort, were very much aware of the danger of tomb robbers and went to some trouble to try and protect themselves against that. Well, if the bodies roll away as soon as you close the tomb or anything, then there's no reason to bother with that. And among the Jews, we know that in the couple centuries before the time of Jesus and up to about 70 AD, destruction of Jerusalem, the Jewish burial practice involved having people put in their family tombs, and then a year later one of the relatives would go into the tomb and gather up the bones and put them in a bone box, an ossuary. So they certainly were well aware that the body had not rolled off into Gehenna or something of that sort. What's the biblical view of hell's location? Well, I think we can illustrate the Bible's teaching from two passages we looked at earlier. One of these is Luke 16, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, and the other one are the last verses of Isaiah 66, 22 through 24. So let's have a look at those. Luke 16, we ask ourselves, what happens to the two men when they die? And we're told that Lazarus died, and the angels carried him away to Abraham's, literally, bosom, okay? Probably the idea of reclining on a couch and feasting with Abraham would be my guess. Well, was Lazarus actually physically carried there? The passage doesn't tell us, so we don't know. My guess is his body is still wherever it was put, whether it was given a decent burial, whether it was thrown on a rubbish heap, and that his spirit or soul is carried away to Abraham. The next verse, verse 23, tells us the rich man died and was buried. And in Hades, he looks up and sees Abraham afar off. So again, I think you see the idea of the body is still in the tomb, and the soul or spirit of the rich man is in Hades. What's that? Well, in English, Hades is kind of a sophisticated, what shall we say, synonym for hell. But the Greek word from which it comes, which briefly Hades, is the unseen world. And had, I believe, in most of the views in antiquity, both a good and a bad part, okay? So the rich man, as we'll see in a moment, as we saw in the passage, is in the bad part, in torment, etc. And it may well be that Abraham and Lazarus are in the good part. That's, we're not really told there. In these two cases of Lazarus and the rich man, I think we have a picture of what we might call the temporary hell, between death and the final resurrection. That's not a standard theological term. The theological term, which covers both cases, is what we call what they call the intermediate state. But that seems to be the suggestion here. The experience as pictured here is seen as being somewhat similar to the sort of things that are reported in out-of-the-body experiences. Kubler-Ross wrote some books about 20 years ago on this subject, and not long ago I remembered the name of the fellow who also did some writing in that direction, but I'm not coming up with it right here. Isaiah 66, this passage appears to be describing a situation after the resurrection. So this is the permanent hell that is most commonly referred to in the Bible. And this would be the bad side of what theologians call the eternal state. Here, hell is located outside the New Jerusalem, which fits at about a dozen passages where Gehenna is used to refer to this situation. Gehenna is a transliteration of a Hebrew, Aramaic word, Valley of Hinnom, okay? The Valley of Hinnom was a real place around the old Jerusalem. It ran down the west side and then across the south side where it met the Kidron Valley. And that was a place where trash was burned outside the old Jerusalem. And so basically the metaphor here, if you like, is that hell is the trash disposal place of the New Jerusalem. A sobering thought. So where is hell? Well, suggests there's a permanent hell. It's also called in Revelation the lake of fire. It's not yet ready, and will be located near the New Jerusalem on the new earth. Okay. Then there's the temporary hell, and that's located in what we would perhaps could call the unseen world. And where is the unseen world? Well, it seems to me various biblical passages on the unseen world suggest that it's in some other spatial dimension. I try to discuss that in my PowerPoint talk, Where is Heaven? Which you might look at if you're interested in some more detail on that. So that, I think, is where hell is. That brings us to the third thing. How do you get there? Let's look at the passages we looked at before describing hell, and extract from them evidence of how those people got there. Isaiah 66, verse 24, we're told they rebelled against God. Matthew 10:28, they were afraid of those who kill merely the body, rather than being afraid of God who can kill the soul as well. Matthew 13, 41 characterizes the ones who face this situation of hell as all who do evil, and verse 49 as the wicked. Mark 9, 42, Jesus says, better to mutilate oneself or be murdered than to sin or cause another to commit sin. So presumably then the people who've gotten there have sinned or caused another to commit sin. Luke 16, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, the rich man is obviously selfish and ignoring the needs of others. In Paul's 2 Thessalonians 1:8, his letter, those who do not know God or obey the gospel of Jesus, presumably mean responding properly to the message about Jesus, the good news about Jesus. Revelation 14:9, we're told, those who worship the beast, and we suggest on the basis of the simplest interpretation of the number 666 that this is the Antichrist. John does not use that term in Revelation, but he does use the term in 1 John, and here the 666, if you take that and write that in Greek, where write it as numbers in Greek, if you like. The Greeks used their alphabet for numbers, a little bit like the Romans, except the Romans only used a few letters. The Greeks used all 24 of their letters, plus three of them that had not been used anymore, so 27 letters. The first nine of them were for 1 through 9, the next nine were through 10 through 90, and the last nine were 100 through 900. And so the 666 would be 600 is chi, or chi. The 60 is xi, or xi. And the 6 is one of these three letters that aren't used anymore in Greek writing, even New Testament times. The letter vav, or digamma, stigma. And one of the shapes of that is very much like a final sigma. And so a writer back in the late 19th century, a fellow named Watson, in one of his novels, had either invented the idea or picked up the idea that if you look at that, you've got a key at the front and a stigma at the end is very much like an abbreviation used in antiquity for Christos, the Messiah, and the Xi in the middle of it looks like a snake, and so it's the snake's Christ, or the serpent's Christ, the Antichrist. So people can get there by worshiping the Antichrist, even though they're threatened with death if they don't. Huh? Revelation 20, verses 12 and 15, we see that people who wind up there are judged by what they've done with their lives. And their name is not written in the book of life, called elsewhere the Lamb's book of life. So how do you get there? Well, apparently, most will get there just by going on as they are. We see in Matthew 7, Jesus says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." Jesus was asked in Matthew 22 about the two great commandments. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." So, question each of us needs to ask ourselves is, do I obey them? Do you obey them? Do we obey them? And the answer, I think, is no. And might ask, have I ever obeyed them? Have you ever obeyed them? Have we ever obeyed them? And the answer, I think, is no. Possibly once or twice in our life we have loved some neighbor as much as we loved ourselves for a brief moment or something, but not really. So how are we going to respond to this? We'd realize that God takes no pleasure in anyone going to hell. Here's what Ezekiel tells us in Ezekiel 33:11. "Say to them, as surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that they turn from their ways and live. Turn, turn from your evil ways. Why will you die, people of Israel?" And then in Peter's second letter, 3:9, "The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he's patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance." But while God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked and wants everyone to come to repentance, Not everyone will. So our response should be, flee to God and seek his pardon. The natural tendency of humans is to run from God. But that's the foolish thing to do. Flee to God and seek his pardon. And God freely offers his pardon on the basis of what Jesus did. Jesus lived a perfectly righteous life. And if we trust in him, his righteous life will be counted as though it was ours. How can that be? Well, in Roman Catholic theology, there's a doctrine called supererogation, which is this, that they believe that the saints, the godly people, the most godly people in history have lived such good lives that they've done way more than God requires, and therefore the extra merit can be given away to others. You know, the trouble with that is, that's false. The Bible teaches that all of us humans, who are merely humans, we're all sinners. And our very best actions are like filthy rags. And that we've never in our whole life loved God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength. And rarely have ever loved our neighbors or self. And so we haven't got any extra righteousness to give away to anyone else. But Jesus did. And how is that? Because he obviously couldn't love God with more than his all of his heart and mind and soul and strength either. Right? But Jesus did because he's the only creature that only being who volunteered to become a creature. By the time we'd been created, we didn't have any choice. And by the time we'd been created, we'd already done a number of sinful things. But Jesus is God, and he voluntarily chose to become a human being. And so all his obedience as a human being is something that was not required of him. It was something he voluntarily chose to do. And so he lived a perfectly righteous life, and he died a terrible death to pay for human sins. So if we trust in Jesus, his good life is credited to us. And the terrible death he suffered counts as though it were our punishment. And Jesus, being God, was able to suffer in a few hours what would take us forever to suffer. So if we trust in Jesus, those two things happen to us. And in addition, which I don't have here as a bullet point, God puts his own spirit within us and begins to change us inside. So, the Bible sets before us two ways, which we might visualize with this graphic here. The way of life on the left here, and the way of death on the right. And this is the end of our talk. The end is not yet. For us personally, it will come when we die, or if we're still alive, when the Lord returns. But the question is, what will we do, what will you do, what will I do with the time we have been given? May the Lord help us to turn to him and ask him that he'll forgive us and ask him to change us that we may avoid God's wrath in hell. Thank you very much for your attention, and I trust the Lord will be with you.